Ladies and gentlemen, my name is Francis Mack Smith, but I prefer that my friends call me Smitty. I'll try my best to recall for you the events that occurred in the greatest single tragedy in the history of the United States Navy. If the Japanese attack on Pearl Harbor was the alpha of World War II, then the sinking of the USS Indianapolis certainly had to be the omega. The Indy was a heavy cruiser. It had been a flagship at various times and had been the favorite ship of choice of President Franklin Roosevelt. It was also the fastest ship in our arsenal at the time and therefore was chosen to carry the atomic warhead from San Francisco to Tinian Island in the Marianas. This, as we all know, was used shortly thereafter to detonate the bomb that destroyed the city of Hiroshima, Japan on August 6, 1945. At the time, I was a 21-year-old naval radio man stationed at Leyte Gulf in the Philippines. Shortly after midnight on July 28th of that year, I received a coded dispatch from the Indianapolis. Unbeknownst to the world, it had already delivered its deadly cargo and was now en route to Leyte Gulf to rendezvous with the Idaho, which was already at anchor and waiting for their orders. The Indy gave me her ETA, or her estimated time of arrival, and asked for a berth anchorage assignment. I sent this info over to the port director, and he shortly thereafter sent me a reply which I relayed on. The Indy responded by giving me a roger, indicating that she understood and would comply with the message, and this later proved to be the last message the Indy ever sent, or at least anyone ever acknowledged.
He was stationed in the island of Samar, which is in the Philippines. And that's where he transmitted and received all the messages. But he was never on the USS Indianapolis.
Patricia Smith is Francis Max Smitty Smith's daughter, who is fulfilling her father's mission to share what he believes is the true story of the sinking of the USS Indianapolis.
He felt very responsible. It was his ship.
He was in communication with that ship quite a bit.
Yes.
On August 1st, I reported for duty at our radio shack. I had graduated from Naval Radio School at Northwestern University 2 years previously and intended on contacting one of my old buddies who was now aboard the Indy. I scanned the arrival sheet and the anchorage map, but there was no indication that the Indianapolis had yet arrived. She was now about 9 hours overdue, so I made an inquiry of my immediate superior, a young ensign, as to her whereabouts. He replied he didn't know but would ask the port director when he contacted him later in the day. I went about my duties and didn't see the ensign until about 4 p.m. when I was going off duty. I was exiting the rear door of our radio shack, which was really a Quonset hut about 200 feet long. I caught sight of the ensign as he pulled up to the front entrance in a Jeep. I shouted an inquiry as to what he had found out. He shrugged his shoulders, threw out both arms as if in exasperation and exclaimed, "Smitty, they wouldn't tell me anything."
He kept asking his commanders. And they just shrugged their shoulders and walked away. And so I guess my dad just left it alone.
I was momentarily surprised, almost stunned with disbelief. But then I accepted the only alternative apparently left to me. I assumed she must have been rerouted to another port of call. But I still felt uneasy and could not understand why we had not been notified. How wrong my assumption was later proven to be. Unknown to me or anyone else at the time was the fact that about 48 hours after our electronic contact with each other, the Indianapolis was hit by two Japanese torpedoes. Shortly after midnight on July 30th, the latest and most modern of the enemy submarines, commanded by Captain Hamashita, in but one of an unbelievable series of quirky fates of destiny, visually sights via his periscope the silhouette of the Indy. Maneuvering his sub about, he eventually fires a salvo of fish at an unsuspecting target. The first torpedo blew the bow completely off, but the Indy, with both of her screws still pushing, plowed through the Pacific, sucking up water like a giant scoop. Then, within a few seconds, came the coup de grace, if such were needed. The second hit blew up the magazine, and the resulting explosion and fires killed, maimed, and caused tremendous chaos among the crew, of course, perhaps, due to the changing of the watch at the time. From half to two-thirds of the crew were up and about, but nevertheless, it was estimated that about 300, or one-fourth of the Indy's complement of 1,200 men, went down with the ship. As explosions ripped the ship apart and fires burned out of control, it was almost a miracle that 880 men, many severely burned or injured, managed to jump or fall into the black oil-covered waters that fateful night so many years ago. The ship's bow, what was left of it, began to go down first. Some of the men had required Kopec life jackets, but many others had nothing. Very few life rafts were released, as the Indy, listing to one side, gave a shudder and sank into the Pacific's depth, gone forever. This whole incredible event transpired in only 10 to 12 minutes.
They all went in shark-infested waters, and they were there for 5 days in the waters and fighting for their life. The Navy didn't even attempt, made no attempt to even look for them. And that is a question I guess we'll all wonder why.
On August 3rd, 1945, Lieutenant Chuck Gwynn, flying his Ventura torpedo bomber, took off from Peleliu Island, the same island my 17-year-old kid brother Rex had 10 months previously given his life for. Lieutenant Gwynn's mission was to find and destroy enemy submarines. About 10:30 a.m., his cable antenna, which trailed out behind the plane, accidentally got entangled in the winch which was used to crank it in. Lieutenant Gwynn left his position and went to the rear to help out. As men worked and peered down through the opening of the bulk winch, they were suddenly shocked to see the sight of hundreds of men in the water beneath them. Still unaware of the overdue Indy, Lieutenant Gwynn sends a message back to Peleliu, informing command of his discovery of men floating in the Pacific. Back on Peleliu, no undue concern was evident. It was not until late afternoon before another young lieutenant, Adrian Marks, is dispatched with a fully loaded PBY Catalina flying boat to airdrop survival gear to the unknown men. As Marks continued picking up the survivors, he radioed for help on the distress frequencies, but not in code. No, he broadcast in plain, simple English for all the world to hear about what he had found at that historic moment. Admiral Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief Pacific Operations, upon being informed of this transmission back in Tinian, reported to have responded by saying, "I have a drunken sailor out there whom I'm going to court-martial." But of course, that never happened. My initial reaction was somewhat different than the Admiral's. First, anger. Why? How could such a thing happen? Finally, remorse and disgust that I had harbored subconsciously for the next 50 years of my life, justifiable or not. Lieutenant Marks, as nightfall descended, eventually managed to pull aboard his plane a total of 56 men from those shark-infested waters, tying to the overhead wing with parachute cord. And then he waited through the long night for the arrival of rescue ships and planes. Many of the wounded succumbed, even as they were en route to land hospitals. Eventually, 317 men did survive, or about one-fourth of the Indianapolis's crew. Shortly after Japan signed the terms of capitulation, my commanding officer, Commander Thomas Green, ordered me and two other seamen to burn thousands of past transmissions at a large incinerator, among them the communication with the Indy.
Was he ever asked questions? I mean, obviously, if he's a radio man, he knows something is wrong.
I think I remember hearing something about my dad saying there's a bunch of papers, And his commander told him that they were to burn them all up. There were some kind of reports, papers, important papers, documents, something about burning them up. They burned all the evidence up. I do remember that.
Did your father feel that there was a cover-up?
I think so.
He informed me it was indeed a direct order, and so he complied with his directive. Shortly thereafter, two U.S. senators at a fact-finding mission flew in from Washington. A board of inquiry took my signed and sworn deposition pertaining to the facts I had knowledge of, and Commander Green, the port director, and other high-ranking officials departed via air back to the States. I remained at my base at Leyte Gulf until the following April of 1946, when I returned home and was discharged from naval service. It was only at this point that I began to learn more, and many of my unanswered questions were resolved. Foremost, of course, was why didn't the Navy seek out the whereabouts of the overdue Indianapolis? The answer was to be found in the interpretation of a top order. Previously, Nimitz headquarters, in an attempt to eliminate excessive message traffic, had issued a communique that shore-based stations, meaning port directors in general, did not have to report the arrivals of the first line of combat ships. Therefore, eventually, the port director at Leyte Gulf, a commander, Sanchez, thought he did not have to report the non-arrival. Also, unbelievable to my way of thinking. He did later receive a reprimand, I understand. Captain McVeigh of the Indy was court-martialed and charged with two counts of dereliction of duty. First, for failure to steer a zigzag course. Second, to order a call to abandon ship. He was found guilty of only the first charge, but all knowledgeable and experienced seamen said that it would have made little difference, especially actually with a magnetized warhead existence. McVeigh's men almost unanimously stood with their captain. Captain Hamashita, the Japanese commander, who sunk the Indy, was flown in by the prosecution, and he too testified it would have made little difference in the outcome. But regardless, McVeigh was stripped of his command and his future tarnished and ruined forever. He would later take his own life by suicide. To this day, many think he had a kangaroo court-martial and was used as a scapegoat.
He has questioned it his entire life. And he has had guilt his entire life.
Where does the guilt come from?
I believe the guilt comes from that my father felt responsible, that he didn't do enough. I always tried to tell him, you were just a young boy, and you did the best you could. But my father, it didn't help. He had such a heart, and it really had an effect on his life.
Does the guilt come from the fact that he later finds out that the ship is torpedoed and all these men were in the waters, in the shark-infested waters, and nobody was there to save them?
Yes.
As the years passed, I became aware of the Indy survivors' attempts to erect a memorial monument in Indianapolis, to call to the nation's attention, if you will, to what they perceived to be, if not a miscarriage of justice, then surely recognition for an honorable ship and captain that had been overlooked or neglected for its rightful place in history.
He just devoted his life to trying to give back and to try to make it right.
What were some of the things that he did or he gave back?
Well, he had a beautiful convertible. They wanted to build a monument in Indianapolis, and my father raffled off a car, and they got about $50,000 for it to help build this monument and to put all the names of the young men that perished in that terrible tragedy. And he just kept writing and writing stories about it, and maybe one day we'll get this book published.
He's raising awareness about what really happened.
Oh, yes, he is. The truth.
We received not $1 in government money, and it took 30 years of endeavorment on the part of many, many volunteers to accomplish our goal. And as it became a reality, the federal government finally passed legislation recognizing and classifying the Indianapolis' Survivors Memorial on an equal status with all other Class A1 war memorials. Persistence and tenacity prevail, and now the world knows. In conclusion, I will point out the series of errors of both commission and omission that occurred in this tragedy. Number one, the battleship Idaho was at anchor in Layette Gulf, awaiting further orders. SINPAC, or Admiral Nimitz, Commander-in-Chief Pacific Operations Staff, sent a radio dispatch to them informing them the Indy was en route to rendezvous with them. Unfortunately, the message was garbled and indecipherable. To this date, I don't understand why a repeat was not sent. They could have done far more than we at the shore base did. Number two, when the Indy left Tinian en route to Leyte Gulf, she left behind her itinerary so they should know her approximate position at any given time. For the later part of the war, we had broken the Japanese code and understood everything they communicated. After sinking the Indy, Captain Hamashita sent a transmission to the Japanese Naval Command. In it, he states, junk sunk Allied battleship of Idaho class at latitude such and such, longitude such and such. Commander-in-Chief Pacific Command had a monitoring station at Tinian that picked up and decoded this information. Unfortunately, again, at least to me, nothing was done. I guess like Admiral Nimitz, they thought because no battleship was in the area, they had a Japanese sailor who had drank too much sake. The silhouette of a heavy cruiser was very similar to a battleship of the Idaho class. Captain Hamashita had misidentified his victim, but a cross-check would have shown the Indy would have been in the approximate position at that time, and in semi-darkness, things tend to look different. Again, demerits and court-martials were threatened, but subsequently dropped. Number three. A few days before the Indy was given her last assignment, a U.S. destroyer was sunk with a significant loss of life in the same general area the Indy was due to traverse through. The Indy was never assigned an escort, nor was she ever informed of the previous sinking. To this day, I wonder why the Indy did not have our latest sonar aboard. Overconfidence? Complacency? What was occurring in the upper echelon of the military minds at this time? And finally, number four. If Captain Himishita would have sunk the Indy before it delivered the atomic cargo, would the war have prolonged? And ironically, Captain Himishita's wife and two children would have lived because, you should know, his family all perished in their homes in Hiroshima. Such are the fortunes of war, it seems.
And my dad would say, it's a rich man's war, and it's a poor man's fight. War solves nothing. There is no good in war. You resolve nothing with war. And just hope that this gets out and the world can realize that we have to come together. And fighting is no answer. It resolves nothing.